Coming up on this special edition of The Green from Delaware Public Media, we continue our 2024 Candidate Conversations series with interviews from the race for Delaware's lone U.S. House seat. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Our look at the U.S. House campaign focuses on two candidates, Republican Danielle Hall and Democrat Sarah McBride. Plus, legislation passed this year now allows human composting in the first state. We take a closer look at the process and its benefits. That's all next on this special edition of The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this special edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. As part of our 2024 election coverage, Delaware Public Media is offering a series of candidate conversations. We reached out to all candidates filed to run in the races for U.S. House and Senate, as well as governor, lieutenant governor, and insurance commissioner, and invited them to sit down with us. Candidates in each race are being asked about the same set of topics to allow you to get to know them and compare them. The interviews you hear here on The Green are edited for time. Full conversations are online at DelawarePublic.org. The race for U.S. House features five candidates seeking to replace Democrat Lisa Blunt Rochester, who is running for U.S. Senate. Today, we focus on the two candidates who responded to our requests for an interview, Republican Danielle Hall and Democrat Sarah McBride. Republican James Whalen and Democrats Earl Cooper and Elias Weir did not respond to Delaware Public Media's interview requests. So we start with Republican Danielle Hall. Hall previously ran for lieutenant governor in 2020, losing to Democrat Bethany Hall Long by a 59-41% margin. Hall also ran for the state Senate in 2018 and lost in the Republican primary for the 17th district seat. So let's talk about some of these issues that you've touched on and some others as well. We'll start with the economy, because voters consistently list that as a top issue. The Biden administration touts low unemployment, strong job numbers, along with some other positive economic indicators as signs the country is headed in the right direction. But inflation, higher prices for many everyday goods leave many people still struggling at this juncture. What would you support Congress doing to promote economic growth if you're elected?
Well, you definitely hit the nail right on the head. Inflation is on the ballot this cycle. People are wanting to know that they're going to have someone who can identify with the pains of the price at the pump, the price at the grocery store cash register, the mounting debt that's sitting on their tables. Housing is anything but affordable. Healthcare is anything but affordable. We're looking in Delaware, where we are seeing another recession and foreclosures are on the rise and people are losing their homes. These are things that I have actually experienced firsthand and know that we have to do some things that will be corrective measures. First of all, the Inflation Reduction Act, that has exacerbated inflation tremendously, where they were looking to actually have the opposite happen. Just wasteful spending has made it so that those numbers have increased and passed those costs in goods and services onto the consumer. And so we have to find places where we can curtail the wasteful spending. I think that being able to have transparency in government and being able to take a good look at where the spending cuts can happen is critical. I bring a business background with an acumen in finance, and I actually served for a number of years in the United States Department of Labor for Veterans Employment and Training Services, where I was responsible for the oversight of the federal dollars that actually tracked into the state's budget. And during that time, we had a quarterly reporting system. So if you didn't meet the requirements to remain funded, you lost your funding. And I think that that speaks volumes to what we can do at Congress at the national level in Congress to be able to make some changes and just being able to take a look at where we're spending and figure out where we can cut that wasteful spending.
How about on the revenue side with taxes? What are your feelings on what Congress should be looking at in terms of tax policy?
Well, I support job growth taxes. I think that in the small business community, again, I'm a small business owner, I think that we need to do some things that will position us well for growth in our economy. And those things will come from dealing with the regulatory guidelines as it applies to business. As you're probably well aware, in the state of Delaware, the state of Delaware is the largest employer and small businesses are the second largest mm-hmm. employer. And so being able to do things that advantageously position our small businesses for growth will stimulate our economy in ways that are meaningful to Delawareans here.
Let's talk about immigration. There was a bipartisan border reform bill ready to go before many Republicans backed away at the behest of former President Trump. Would you support that bill if elected?
I think that we absolutely need to close our southern border immediately. Mm-hmm. I think that the policies that were under the Trump administration were working for us. And I think that under the Biden administration, we opened our borders and we allowed a large influx, which has caused a devastating effect to us economically here and our safety as well. I would support measures that would immediately close our borders.
So you would probably go beyond what that bill is looking to do.
Absolutely.
The former president has also at this point discussed mass deportations if he is elected. Is that something that you would support?
I think that when we look at deporting people who don't belong here and obviously did not come in by the correct means to this country, I think that we have no other alternative but to find ways of making sure that those people who illegally crossed our borders return to the places where they came from.
Okay. Following the Supreme Court's decision overturning Roe v. Wade, the issue of abortion was left to the states. And that has created a patchwork of approaches across the country and leaving questions about other related reproductive issues like IVF. Do you feel Congress should step in some way on this issue?
I think that it needs to remain a state's issue, and I'm comfortable leaving at the states to make those decisions and what's best for each state.
So Delaware right now is a state that is, you know, much more open to abortion and reproductive rights. You're fine with allowing Delaware to continue doing what it's doing if that's what the will of the General Assembly and the population
Absolutely.
Is.
Absolutely.
Okay. I want to talk a little foreign policy. Israel and Gaza. President Biden's been seeking a ceasefire in Gaza for some time, to no avail so far. What approach do you feel the U.S. should be taking in approaching this conflict?
Well, you know, again, my family has a long history mm-hmm. of military service, and I think that just having skin in the game that way makes a difference in approach. I think that when I look at my own family, one of my younger sons that just recently separated from the Air Force was actually serving in Jordan on those same sands where those soldiers recently lost their lives. And when I think about what we need to be doing overseas in our foreign policy, I would definitely not like to see us have a huge ground presence in these countries. I do support us being an ally to Israel and doing what is necessary to make sure that we keep that relationship strong.
The war in Ukraine continues as well. Where do you stand on continuing support to Ukraine as it seeks to fend off the Russian invasion? It's now about 2.5 years old.
Well, again, I am not a strong proponent for ground troops. I've looked at some of the proposals that have been made, and I don't want to see us commit for 10 years either to financially back any of those things either. I think that it is quite obvious that over the last several years that we have weakened our position of strength, and I think that there is strength through peace, and I think that there is a necessary means to make sure that we are not looking weak on the global stage as well. So I would like to see us do some things that would strategically place us back in a position of strength, and I would also like us to do what we can to make sure that we don't overextend ourselves in these areas militarily.
So on the side of things that we can do, are there some things you would suggest to portray that position of strength better?
I think that the financial side and providing resources, I think that there are some things that we could do strategically to help in those regions without overextending ourselves to a commitment that it puts us in country for the next decade.
I was going to say, so, I mean, when you talk about specifically Ukraine, I mean, do you feel, is it fair to say you support continuing aid and support short term, but you would want to assess it kind of on an ongoing basis?
Absolutely.
Okay. Curious what you feel Congress and the federal government's role is in climate change. What should the federal government and Congress specifically, if you're elected, be doing to address the issues that surround climate change?
Well, I know that when I take a look at things here locally, we have a renewable energy portfolio standard that currently we didn't meet the deadline that we had originally set for ourselves. And it kind of kicked it down the road a little bit, about 5 years. We don't here in Delaware create enough of our own green energy. And I think that we have to be a little bit more strategic as it concerns to our region, how we approach renewable energy portfolio standards, because we're pricing ourselves out of the market in a lot of regards. And I think the average consumer is feeling that pinch again economically with the electric bill and the gas bill. And we've talked about going to the EV mandates, and it's just not sustainable. And I think that while we are having the conversation about moving more toward green energy, there are certainly some things that we could do that move us away from the more harmful fossil fuels and be able to, again, position ourselves well to where we can find that compromise. But again, we have to have those discussions that position us.
Since we're talking about a federal office in Congress, would you be supportive of more incentives, tax breaks or incentives from the federal government to promote those renewables to perhaps lower the pinch, as you were calling it, on consumers on their electric bill? Would you be in favor of doing something like that where maybe the onus goes off the local consumer if there's some federal incentives or tax breaks to promote that type of move toward renewables?
I think anytime you have a conversation around money, you have to figure out where the balance is again. And it's hard to say with one broad brushstroke that, you know, we could just offer an incentive at the federal level that would offset the local level. Again, I think that, you know, that calls for us to have a little bit more in-depth conversation and take a look at the numbers and figure out where those price points are and exactly what strategically we could do.
But it's a conversation you'd like to have.
Absolutely.
This is a time where there seems to be a stronger distrust of governments and perhaps maybe even more specifically of politicians, and that has led to calls for more transparency and accountability. If elected, what role do you feel you could personally play and play as a member of Congress in delivering greater transparency and accountability to build trust in government?
Well, that's been something that I have been advocating for a long time. And I absolutely agree that the more transparent and open that we can be about where our spending is, that promotes nothing but trust. And when people feel that you are not hiding anything or being dishonest about where the spending is going, you know, there's always the thought that there are the behind the scenes closed door deals that people just don't have privy to. I think that if we establish measurable outcomes and metrics to be able to really see the impact for where we are spending, I think that that will also communicate a level of sincerity about being open and transparent, because at the end of the day, you'll be able to see that the intended end user is actually being favorably impacted. And if they're not being favorably impacted, then we need to go back to the drawing board and get rid of those things that aren't working or fix them.
It feels like a lot of this distrust or just concerns about government is fueled by rhetoric, right? In the wake of the assassination attempt on former President Trump, there was a lot of discussion of things, you know, people need to cool things down, lower the temperature a little bit. It doesn't seem like very much of that has taken. Do you feel we've reached a very critical point in terms of our democracy, and is democracy somewhat at risk the way we discuss politics and the way the rhetoric drives what we do in government?
I have a very personal feeling about the rhetoric, and I believe that sometimes it's divisive intentionally. And sometimes I think by polarizing people with knee-jerk reactions and putting people in corners where there is no consensus, that there's not a need to pay attention to the issues that really matter at the end of the day. And I feel very strongly that we have to have voices of reason that will pull people out of the polar opposite sides of the room to have a conversation that will be able to find the solution that we need that would best benefit the people. And I think that that is a necessary skill to have. And I make light of it sometimes. But, you know, with 10 children in my own walls, I've had some pretty heated squabbles inside of my own living room. So I can understand how being able to have the spirit of compromise put in play and be able to bring people together to get the work done that's in the best interest of the people.
I do want to close out by asking if there's an issue we haven't discussed that you feel is not getting the attention it deserves in this election cycle and how you would address it if elected.
Something that's not getting addressed. You know, everything but the kitchen sink is being addressed. And I don't think that there's an area that we have necessarily not covered. One of the things that I would always encourage voters to do is their homework. Do the deep dive on your candidates. I've been hashtagging my post over the years, vote your values and not your party affiliation. You know, there's some good Democrats, there's some good Republicans out there, and there's even some independents that are running. So, you know, it's incumbent upon all of us to do our homework and research our candidates, find out where they stand, give them a call. If, you know, it's not on the site, I encourage people to call me. People are always excited that the number that's on my website actually rings to my personal cell phone. So I'm happy to answer questions regarding where I stand on the issues that are important to you. So I encourage people to reach out to those folks that are vying for their vote and find out if they're worthy of it.
That's Republican candidate for U.S. House Danielle Hall. Our full conversation with her is available at DelawarePublic.org. Up next, our candidate conversation with one of the Democrats in the U.S. House race, State Senator Sarah McBride. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You are listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. We continue our candidate conversations with more from the race for U.S. House, where we now turn to Democrat Sarah McBride. McBride was elected to the Delaware State Senate in 2020, representing the Wilmington area 1st District, and won re-election unopposed in 2022. She previously served as the National Press Secretary for the Human Rights Campaign, the country's largest LGBTQ advocacy organization, and during the 2016 Democratic National Convention became the first openly transgender person to address a national party convention. A reminder, the candidate conversations you hear here on The Green are edited for time. Full conversations are online at DelawarePublic.org. So let's talk about some of these issues that you've already touched on a little bit, starting with the economy, because voters consistently list that as a top issue. Biden administration touts low unemployment, relatively strong job numbers over recent months, along with some other positive economic indicators, as signs the country is headed in the right direction. But inflation and higher prices on many everyday goods still leave a lot of people struggling. So what would you be supporting in Congress and doing in Congress to promote economic growth, to help those, as I guess you said, the kitchen table issues that people are facing?
Sure. Well, the number one priority for the next Congress has to be bringing down costs facing workers and families in Delaware and across the country. It means investing in more affordable housing here in Delaware. It means passing legislation guaranteeing affordable childcare for every single family in our state, including universal pre-K. It means passing paid family and medical leave at the federal level to build on the progress that we've made here in Delaware so that workers no longer have to choose between their health and their job, between their paycheck and their family. It means investing in healthcare to bring down the costs facing patients across our state by helping recruit more providers here in Delaware and expanding coverage to communities and for services that too long had been denied coverage. it means bringing down these costs that in many cases break the bank when families face them. But in so many instances, these are inevitable challenges of life. And we can do more to support people and their families as they face those inevitable challenges. And if we invest in childcare and housing and healthcare, we'll address some of the most significant drivers of the cost increases that our families are facing. But in order to do that, we actually have to get things done. And so from day one, I'll be focused on those policies that'll impact families in their pocketbooks and help make the American dream more affordable for them.
Where does tax policy fit into that equation?
Sure. We shouldn't be increasing taxes on working families. We should be maintaining Delaware's competitiveness. That means we need federal investment to tackle some of the big issues that the state is facing. But we can do that without raising taxes on working people. President Biden had proposed what was called the Build Back Better Act back in 2021, which would have provided universal affordable child care, paid family and medical leave, historic investments in housing and elder care and home care. And it was all paid for without raising taxes on anyone making under $400,000 a year. So anyone who tells you that we can't meet the needs of workers and families without increasing taxes on them hasn't done their homework, and they don't realize that there's a proposal right in front of us that will do just that.
Let's move on to immigration. There was a bipartisan border reform bill ready to go before many Republicans backed away at the behest of former President Trump. Would you support that bill if elected? And if so, do you view it as a first step with more to do?
Yes, I would absolutely support the border security bill that President Biden, Vice President Harris negotiated with congressional Republicans. It was ready to go. But as you mentioned, Donald Trump nixed it. Donald Trump gave his orders to his Republican followers in Congress, and they crashed a deal, a historic bipartisan deal that could have helped secure the border and also make our immigration system more efficient and humane for the people interacting with it. But unfortunately, we know that petty, toxic politics, partisan politics, too often get in the way of progress. That's why we need to elect people to Washington, D.C., who are willing to move past those incentives in our politics that push us into our silos and know how to find common ground to actually deliver for people. And frankly, it means electing Vice President Harris and now Governor Tim Walz to the White House and to the executive branch. It means flipping the House of Representatives and keeping Democrats in the Senate, because what the Republican Party in Congress has made clear over the last several years is they are unwilling to deliver bipartisan results unless Democrats are in charge.
Even if that bill did pass, going back to the question I asked, is that a first step? Would there be more to do in your mind, even if that bill does go through?
Sure. It's an important next step, but there is more to do. We have to make sure we're grappling with the millions of undocumented folks that are living here in the United States right now, which is why I would be supportive of what had previously been bipartisan consensus in support of a pathway to citizenship for those who are presently here, who are working and paying their taxes. Because at the end of the day, we have to make the system protect our country and secure our borders, but also guarantee that those who are living here, who are productive, contributing members of society, are able to come out of the shadows and live full, productive lives.
Following the Supreme Court's decision overturning Roe v. Wade, the issue of abortion has been left to the states, and that has created a patchwork, obviously, of approaches and left questions about other related reproductive issues like IVF. How do you feel? Well, first of all, do you feel Congress should step in some way? And if so, how?
Absolutely. During my time in the Delaware State Senate, as we have faced significant attacks on reproductive freedom from the Supreme Court, we've protected the right to choose in Delaware. We've made this state a safe state, a sanctuary state for patients and providers to get the full range of health care that they need, including the full range of reproductive health care. But we should not lull ourselves into a false sense of complacency here in Delaware, because the reality is, if Donald Trump and J.D. Vance get full control of the federal government, they will ban abortion nationwide. We should take them at their original word. We should look at what they've already done, and we should look at what they've done in Texas and Alabama and states like that where they do have full control. They will ban abortion nationwide if they have the opportunity, and that means they will ban abortion in Delaware. And so we need a strong pro-reproductive freedom champion in the United States House of Representatives. That's what I've been throughout my career. It's what I'll be in Congress, because we need to do what we've done in Delaware and enshrine reproductive freedom under federal law to guarantee that we're making it as difficult as possible for these Trump MAGA extremists to ban abortion nationwide, which they will do if given the chance.
I do want to talk about a couple of foreign policy issues, starting with Israel and Gaza. President Biden has been seeking a ceasefire in Gaza to no avail so far. What do you believe the U.S. approach should be in this very complex conflict?
Well, it is a complex conflict, and I think President Biden has been dealt a very difficult hand, but has navigated it with the statesmanship that we know is a hallmark of Joe Biden's career. I think, like so many people, I've been heartbroken with the images that I've seen on the news, from the October 7th terrorist attack to the war in Gaza, to the ongoing hostage crisis. And I yearn for peace, I think, like all good people do. That's why I've been so supportive of this administration's efforts to secure a long-lasting ceasefire that provides a bridge to the conclusion of this war and hopefully the establishment of a two-state solution that results in a safe and secure Israel and a Palestinian state free from the oppression of Hamas that is stable and able to thrive for the Palestinian civilians that call it home. That is the only path toward a truly sustainable peace in the Middle East. And the first step is securing the ceasefire deal that the United States has negotiated, that has historically been accepted by Israel, and that we need Hamas to accept as well, because that is the only path toward a peaceful resolution here.
The other major ongoing foreign policy issue is the war in Ukraine. Where do you stand on continuing to support Ukraine, specifically financially, as it seeks to fend off the Russian invasion that is now about 2.5 years old?
Well, there's no question that we have to continue to stand with our allies, including Ukraine, as they fend off the illegal invasion by Russia. We have to be clear that if we aren't supporting Ukraine in their effort to stave off Russia and to keep Ukraine a democracy with the right of self-determination, if we don't help Ukraine successfully push back Russian forces, there is a very real chance that the situation could escalate in Europe, because at that point, Russia would be on the fringes of the NATO alliance. And an emboldened Russia under a despot wannabe like Vladimir Putin could be capable of anything. And so in order to prevent the risk of a conflict that ensnares NATO, we have to defeat Russia in Ukraine. And that will only happen if the United States and our allies, including in the European Union, continue to support the Ukrainian military financially and with military support.
I do want to touch on climate change, because that is an issue that is both important domestically and obviously globally as well. What role can Congress play and the federal government play in best addressing climate change?
Sure. Well, we saw in the Biden administration and the Biden-Harris administration the most significant step of any nation on Earth ever to combat the existential threat of climate change with the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, which was a historic investment in addressing and preventing climate change. We have to build on that progress. We have to continue to invest in renewables, including guaranteeing that Delaware has the support necessary to fund our transition to renewable energy in this state. But we also have to build on that progress. Senator Coons has a bipartisan bill that would help to incentivize some of the larger polluters in our economy to continue to limit even further their carbon emissions. That should be at the top of the agenda. We've pulled the lever on funding. We should pull the lever on policy. We also have to invest internationally in preventing climate change, because the reality is climate change doesn't care about borders. And while we have done a lot here domestically in the United States, we've also got to make sure that there is a truly global response to this global crisis. I think those are the next steps, but we have a strong foundation to build off of with the Inflation Reduction Act. And look, this is this is a critical issue for Delaware because we are the lowest lying state in the nation. And when we're talking about the costs facing families, we can't ignore the reality that for our coastal communities, climate change poses a real risk to their families, to their homes, to their very communities. And we can't ensure that we're addressing those long-term cost issues facing families if we're not protecting the values of the homes of the people who live in eastern Sussex and eastern Kent along the coast, who are at severe risk of not just extreme weather, but of course, rising sea levels.
I want to go back to something you kind of touched on at the beginning of all this, and it's something we were talking with each candidate in all races about, and that is this sense of addressing distrust in government, because it seems there is a stronger distrust of government and maybe particularly politicians at this point, and calls for more transparency and accountability. If elected, what role do you feel you could play personally in delivering greater transparency and accountability and building that trust in government?
Sure. I think that's a great question because I think there are two drivers of distrust in government and in politicians right now. One is certainly a fear around government being in the pockets of the wealthy few. The fear that government isn't looking out for everyday people, the fear that either soft or hard corruption has crept into our politics and our government in too many instances through the power of money and influence. It's one of the reasons why in the Delaware State Senate, I have been the leader of the charge to combat corruption and actually passed bipartisan legislation that took Delaware's anti-corruption and public trust laws from some of the weaker laws in the nation to some of the strongest laws in the nation to prevent government corruption and restore public trust. Because when a person in a position of political power abuses their trust, they don't just victimize the people that they're abusing or the specific finances that they're abusing. They undermine our democracy itself. They commit a crime against our democracy itself by undermining public trust. But I think the second driver of the lack of public trust that people feel is the fear that government just won't work for them, that people won't deliver on their promises. Every 2 or 4 years, we hear elected officials and candidates come before people and talk about what they're going to do. And too often, they don't deliver on it. But I'm running as a candidate who said in 2019, when I announced my candidacy for the state Senate, we're going to pass paid family and medical leave. We're going to expand access to health care. We're going to increase the minimum wage to $15 an hour. We're going to pass historic gun safety measures. We've been able to do all of those things and more in the Delaware General Assembly. I've delivered on the promises that I've made to the constituents I represent. And in Congress, I'll deliver for Delawareans. I'll deliver the policies that I promise in this campaign because I know how to make government work better for people. And we can't address public trust unless we actually deliver for people and keep the promises we make in our elections.
You mentioned the idea of undermining democracy. And I'm curious, do you feel, based on what you just said, and kind of the level of rhetoric in politics right now, that democracy is at a risky tipping point at this juncture?
Without question. I think all of us know what's at stake. Democracy is at risk because there are far too many people on the cusp of power who've demonstrated, if not an indifference to democracy, outright hostility to democracy, outright hostility in honoring elections and honoring the will of the people, outright hostility to Congress functioning by fostering an insurrection. We've seen outright hostility by far too many people in our politics to democracy itself. But we also too often see hostility from politicians toward the people they represent. And that is unconscionable. And that puts democracy at risk. We have to build a government that respects everyone, people who agree with us and people who disagree with us. We have to have a conversation across disagreement. We do have to bring down the temperature in some of the rhetoric, because at the end of the day, democracy only works if we can have a national dialogue, if we view the people who vote differently than us, not as enemies, but neighbors who disagree. That's, I think, the Delaware way in so many ways, that we can disagree agreeably. We need more of that in Congress. It's how I've conducted myself throughout my time in the Delaware General Assembly, bringing Democrats and Republicans together on big issues, on really complicated issues. But we need people in Washington who are willing and able to bring their colleagues together, but also truly respect and see everyone that they represent, whether they are Democrats, Republicans, or independents.
I want to wrap up by asking you if there's an issue you feel we haven't discussed that is not getting the attention it deserves in this election cycle and how you could address it if elected.
Well, look, I think that we all need to be focused squarely on the challenges that workers and families in our state are facing. Affordable housing and healthcare, affordable childcare, paid family and medical leave, strong public schools. And we need to send people to Washington who understand those issues, but also understand how to deliver on those issues. That's why I've been endorsed by Congresswoman Blunt Rochester in this campaign to succeed her in the United States House of Representatives. It's why I've been endorsed by more than 25 labor unions across the state. It's why I've been endorsed by the Delaware Democratic Party, Governor Carney, and local elected officials of both parties, because they know that Delaware's next member of Congress needs to be qualified and effective from day one. Someone who will be able to deliver the policies and investments that Delawareans need. That's why they are supporting my campaign. It's why I'm running, and it's why I hope to earn the vote of Delawareans in September and in November.
That's Democratic candidate for U.S. House Sarah McBride. Our full conversation with her is available at DelawarePublic.org. A reminder, Delaware Public Media also reached out to three other candidates in this race, Republican James Whalen and Democrats Earl Cooper and Elias Weir. They did not respond to Delaware Public Media's requests for an interview. And stay with us. Legislation passed this year now allows human composting in the first state. We take a closer look at the process and its benefits. That's next on this special edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on this special edition of The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. Human composting officially became legal in the first state this year. It's a process that involves the body decomposing into soil, which is then given back to the families of the deceased. Delaware is one of just 12 states to allow it, as more Americans look to environmentally friendly alternatives to conventional burial and cremation. Earth Funeral, an organic reduction provider in Washington state, helped guide Delaware's plans for this alternative practice. And this week, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon spoke with Earth Funeral CEO and co-founder Tom Harries about human composting and how it works.
Human composting is a concept that sounds fairly straightforward, but I think there's a lot to unpack here. So can you define human composting to start things off for us and how long this method, so to speak, has been around?
Yeah, absolutely. So at the highest level, human composting is an environmentally friendly alternative to burial and cremation. It's probably most similar to cremation in that it's an indoor process, but instead of being turned into ash via fire, you're getting gently transformed into nutrient-rich soil using microbes. So at the absolute highest level, it's the process by which a body is gently transformed into nutrient-rich soil. The process was first legalized in Washington state in 2019 or 2020. That was state number one. Delaware became state number 10, and we're up to 12 states in total now. So it's gained pretty quick momentum.
Yeah, I'd say so. When it comes to concerns, what have you heard from people regarding those? Is there a common thread here? Are there any sentiments that you usually hear from folks who are concerned about human composting?
Yeah, so I think a lot of the concern comes from misunderstanding, and the concern comes from just being a bit suspicious of things that are new. But fundamentally, what we find it comes down to is people are uncomfortable questioning their own mortality. And actually, if you think a little bit about the process of being embalmed and buried, it's not particularly pleasant. If you think about the process of being cremated at 1500 degrees, it's arguably not very pleasant. And we find that composting falls in that category too, where it's more a question of considering your own mortality than anything specifically wrong with our process. And our process is much more tech-driven and science-driven than human composting might suggest. Is optimizing a completely natural process, is doing that through a state-of-the-art vessel, it's using proprietary science, that sort of thing. So this is not just, as some legislators have said, throwing a body on a compost pile. This is a high-tech, completely safe, highly tested process.
I've read some of that commentary out there, like people not wanting to, you know, be turned into soil or tomatoes or whatnot, among other things, you know, commentary that echoes, you know, sentiments of isn't this what cemeteries, you know, do already? The bodies in their coffins eventually decompose. The same can kind of go for the cremation process. You know, what's the difference? Why is this needed? That kind of thought process feels like an uphill climb. You, regardless of how fast this has happened in the past, you know, 5-6 years, it feels like an uphill climb that you probably continuously have to make. Am I on base with that? Or are more people, states, lawmakers, whoever it may be, are they more open to this than we might think?
Yeah, so I would start by a lot of the context behind human composting comes from the fact that the traditional funeral industry is not very sustainable. So you've got burial, which has been the long, long established method, but burial's using a lot of valuable urban land, for example. It's arguably not the best use of land in a lot of urban cities. It's also putting all sorts of harmful pollutants into the ground, non-degradable wood, metal, concrete, embalming fluid, which is ultimately just toxic chemical. And then cremation, kind of entertainingly, has been considered the environmentally friendly alternative. But in my definition of environmentally friendly, a fossil fuel-driven process that overtly emits plumes of smoke and other toxic gases is not friendly to the environment in any way, shape, or form. So that sort of has driven the popularity or rising popularity of composting. But also, it's a gentle, natural process. It is better for the environment, but it also offers this return to nature too. So the soil from the compost process, the compost gets used for conservation projects, so reforestation projects, maybe wildfire restoration on the West Coast, restoring challenged ecosystems. So it's this really nice return to nature. And touching upon your point about legislators and regulators, what's really interesting about the legislation is this has been really grassroots driven. This is not like big composting or like the big composting industry really driving this. This is people seeing this in their respective states, being like, I like the idea of that. I'm going to contact one of my local assembly members, senators, representatives, whoever, and try and get this passed in my state. So it's grown very organically because people resonate with this process.
Yeah, and it is indeed growing at a pretty darn fast pace, at least here in the States. Let's get into the finer details of human composting then. From start to finish, how long does this process take?
Yeah, so for Earth, the process takes about 30 to 45 days. So it's much quicker than people realize, but also it's never going to be as quick as cremation. That's kind of the beauty of it. To us, that is representative of the fact that it's a natural process and it's a gentle process. This is not going to take 2 hours. This is a gentle, natural process.
Well, how much soil then is, you know, produced from this? I'm guessing it depends on the person.
Yes, correct. So the length of process and the amount of soil produced depends on the size of the person. So the average person is going to produce about 0.5 cubic yard of soil. And that's why we have conservation partners, because 0.5 cubic yard of soil, for listeners who perhaps don't know how much that is probably a couple of wheelbarrows full. So it's too much soil for most people. So what we find is the majority of people we work with take a few portions. So we have these sort of small biodegradable containers. You can scatter the soil, you can plant the soil, you do something that's meaningful to you and your family. And then we offer families the ability to donate to conservation projects. So we currently operate on the West Coast at the moment. So we have a beautiful piece of land on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington, which we're reforesting. And then we're partnered with a land trust on near the Sierra Nevada mountain range on the West Coast, where we're doing an ecosystem restoration project. So it's a piece of land that's been historically aggressively agricultured, and we're using this compost to return it to a native savanna ecosystem. So this is the really cool part about it, is not only is it a nicer process for the individual, not only is it better for the environment, it offers this really amazing legacy of restoring and protecting land for future generations too.
So you said people usually take X amount of that soil. Is there something that people might normally do with the soil that you hear back in terms of, you know, feedback or whatnot?
We've just launched a series called Lasting Legacies, and we're learning more about the people that are choosing our services and what they're doing with the soil. And it's been fascinating to learn all the different things that people do with this soil. So we've heard people planting memorial gardens. We've heard people planting bushes, potted plants. We've had people who went on multi-state road trips that they did with their lost loved one and scattered the soil in every place that they stopped on that road trip. We have people who keep the soil. And this is the beauty of it, is I think soil is so much more accessible than cremated remains, much more approachable. It's something we're used to versus cremated remains, which I feel like we're quite hands-off and sort of cautious about. So I think it's a really nice way to honor your loved one through the flexibility that soil allows.
And again, I'm sure there's a lot of factors that play into this and a lot of context from person to person, but are you able to ballpark what it might normally cost?
Yeah, so we are about $5,000. So actually incredibly reasonable. I think the average burial in the US is well over $10,000. It depends by state a little bit. The East Coast is typically significantly more expensive than the West Coast. I think cremation is not going to be that much less. And in many instances, it's more. So we're pretty comparable to existing options, if not significantly cheaper.
Well, is there a body type or a kind of person, something, whatever, that wouldn't qualify for this?
So I think this is part of the, is this a safe process conversation? And this is a safe process because there is eligibility criteria. There is regulation of the process itself. And then there are test requirements of the soil output too. So people can be very assured that the soil output is safe for humans, plants, animals, etc. The eligibility criteria I talk about precludes a very small number of people. And this is if you died in a radiological accident. This is if you had Ebola. This is if you had prion disease, which is mad cow disease, that sort of thing. So for 99.99% of people, you're perfectly eligible. And the small percent who die from Ebola, unfortunately, will be precluded.
Yeah, so pretty extreme qualifiers there. So what would you say to someone then if they're interested in going this route, but, you know, do have some concerns about doing it? What do you say to them?
So at Earth, we host a lot of people at our facility. And this can either be virtual or this can be in person. And what's really exciting about how we've thought about our facilities is we realize we're having to normalize this as a concept. We realize that people have to trust us. So we're creating these really architecturally beautiful facilities, which has not been an approach that anyone's really taken to the funeral industry before. Maybe you've got like a fancy funeral home, but you've never had like a nice crematory. So our facility is state of the art. We invest a lot of money. We invite families to come and visit. And you can see the vessel we use and how it's state of the art. You can use the natural material we use as part of the process. Organic mulch, wood chip, wildflower. You can meet our team. And people who do come and visit, again, whether that's in person or virtual, I think leave excited. And that's a strange word to use in a funeral space. People are rarely excited because actually a lot of what we do is people planning and pre-paying for the future, which is a generally recommended piece of end-of-life planning. But people are excited by this option, which cannot be said for cremation. And I'm not sure it can be said for burial and the other options either. For us, this is consumer choice. If you would like to be composted, we're here to make that as easy a process as possible for you. And if you want to be cremated or buried, like, that's your prerogative. And that's the beauty of the US. It's a free country. That's a lot of the argument behind legislating this. Is it's consumer choice. And ultimately, states that don't pass legislation, people just go to the neighboring states.
Thanks to Earth Funeral CEO and co-founder Tom Harries and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on The Green this week. And that's all we have time for on this special edition of The Green. The interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible. Our Candidate Conversations producers, Ethan Grandin, Jeet Hanslin, and Robert Stice. And Delaware Public Media senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernstein. Thanks for joining us on this special edition of the show. And we'll see you again Friday for our regular edition of The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.